From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Mumia Abu-Jamal and other death row prisoners in Pennsylvania end their hunger strike, declaring victory. Should biogenetically engineered carrot bites be classified as organic? Part 2 of our discussion over the proposed USDA organic food standards. The president's own HIV council slams the administration over its opposition to needle exchange, and a look at a lawsuit in Cincinnati on campaign finance spending. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge in Los Angeles has struck down virtually all remaining provisions of Proposition 187, driving one more nail into the coffin of the California ballot initiative, which was passed in 1994 to deny social services to illegal immigrants, but has been blocked by court challenges ever since. The ruling issued late Tuesday by Judge Mariana Falzer of Federal District Court in Los Angeles confirmed and elaborated on her preliminary ruling last November when she found that the measure unconstitutionally usurped federal authority over immigration policy. Falzer's final ruling paves the way for an appeal by California Governor Pete Wilson, who made Proposition 187 a centerpiece of his reelection campaign in 1994. This news from Nigeria. Gunmen killed at least 31 mourners on their way to bury a dead relative in Nigeria's volatile Niger River Delta region. The Independent Vanguard newspaper said the funeral party, including 10 women and 11 children, were near the village of Anuber Sunday when it was attacked by gunmen from the neighboring community. Other newspapers said the bodies had been dismembered before being thrown into the water after a ritual at the local shrine. The Niger Delta, where most of Nigeria's more than 2 million barrels per day of crude oil is pumped, is an impoverished region riven by community rivalry and ethnic hatred, which boils over in sporadic clashes. Meanwhile, about the time the Pope arrives in Nigeria on Saturday, a closed-door tribunal will be deciding the fate of 26 alleged conspirators accused of plotting to overthrow General Sani Abacha's military regime. Human rights groups continually agree that those accused of coup plotting are simply dissidents that Sani Abacha wants to put away. Later, the Pope will pay a courtesy call on the dictator, Sani Abacha, who seized power in 1993, dissolved the government, and imposed martial law. The apparent winner of that year's presidential elections, Masoud Abiola, is languishing in prison, biding his time until Abacha sees fit to carry out his delayed execution. Pakistan's foreign minister, Gauhar Ayub Khan, today warned that India's statements that it will keep its options open over nuclear weapons could push South Asia into a dangerous arms race. In a speech to the Conference on Disarmament, he also called on the 61-member Geneva body, mired in a year-long stalemate, to make nuclear disarmament its highest priority for negotiations. Khan said that reportedly more than 20 countries had the potential to build nuclear weapons but did not name them. Pakistan's disarmament minister took the floor to ask the United Nations-sponsored forum to denounce India's policy and urge it not to develop or deploy nuclear arms. The two nations have fought three wars since they won independence from Britain in 1947 and remain uneasy neighbors. Indonesian police have detained 60 dissidents as they continue to go after students in Sumatra who took to the streets in the cities of Jakarta and Surabaya Thursday after the end of a 25-day ban on street protests. The ban had been imposed to prevent unrest during a session of the People's Consultative Assembly that last week re-elected the general to a seventh five-year term of office. That assembly is largely hand-picked by the dictator. This news from Washington. The Pentagon, disparaged a decade ago for buying $640 toilet seats, is still not the world's smartest shopper. Defense Department buyers recently purchased 108 electrical helicopter bells for $714 each, even though the same bells were previously priced at a mere $47. They paid $75 for each of nearly 2,000 set screws that usually sell for 57 cents apiece. And they spent more than $38,000 for more than 30,000 aircraft springs, previously priced at $1,500. This news from Germany. Dozens of anti-nuclear protesters blocked the exit from a power station in southern Germany today to prevent a politically sensitive shipment of nuclear waste being transported across Germany. Demonstrators sat in the road outside of a nuclear power plant south of Stuttgart, where three containers of waste are expected to be driven out by lorry at any time over the next few days. Germany's anti-nuclear lobby has in the past organized large protests against the transport of nuclear waste, and 6 months before a general election, the planned shipments have taken on political overtones. And finally, a report by the General Accounting Office, an investigative arm of Congress, says that planes, helicopters, and ships sent to Mexico by the United States have largely been inoperable, inadequate, or ineffective in the fight against drug trafficking. Government inspectors suggest poor planning and coordination, particularly by the Pentagon. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host, Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy. And how do you get on that Pentagon supplier list? I've got a few used pens that I think might fetch a good price.
What do you think you could get for them? 1,000? 2,000?
Well, maybe at least enough so that I wouldn't have to work that much this year.
And now that you're about to get your college degree, you might even be able to charge more. Juan,
oh, Amy, you're not going to bring that up, are you?
Is it true that you've just finished your last college paper?
Yes, there is a problem here. Yes, I had a 30-year incomplete that I just finished this week, and you would bring it up. But
could you please explain what it is we're talking about here? Now, I've heard of procrastinators.
Well, actually, no. This was as you know, but most of the listeners don't. I was at Columbia in my senior year in 1968 when the student strike broke out, and got involved in it, and was suspended from the college a couple of weeks before graduation, and didn't find out until many years later that I'd gotten my credits, but that there was an old incomplete in my physics class from my junior year, which I had forgotten all about. And so now, 30 years later, I finally finished. The professor is still alive and still retired, but still teaching occasionally at Columbia. And so he remembered me very well. And he said, as far as I'm concerned, we just have a 30-year incomplete here. So I just had to write a paper for my physics class.
Isn't it true he particularly remembered you because you were one of the student negotiators around the strike? And he was one of the
faculty negotiators, yes. So we were on the opposite ends of the table on the period of the strike, yes.
All right. So what did you write your paper on?
You don't want to know, do you?
He suggested,
the professor suggested the topic since he knew my radical history. He said to me, why don't you write the paper, as I told you 30 years ago to write it, on is scientific socialism scientific? And I said, professor, you know, after all that's happened in the last few years, that's a very, very good question. So that was the 21-page paper, which I handed it to him yesterday.
How long was it?
21 pages.
Now, when are we going to have the graduation party for all our listeners around the country?
I'm assuming that I passed the course, right?
Well, we'll find out. Maybe we'll have your professor on. How old is he now?
I think he's in his 80s.
He is. Okay, well, I'm looking forward to that discussion, what he thought of Juan Gonzalez's paper. Many, many, thousands of columns later, can Juan write a college physics paper? Well, we're going to move on to another issue of science right now. The president's own advisory panel on AIDS angrily criticized this week the Clinton administration's inaction on what they call life-saving needle exchange programs. In the most dramatic split to date between the 32-member panel and the White House, the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS called on Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala to lift the ban on federal funding for needle exchange programs. The latest battle follows a nationwide organizing effort by a coalition of AIDS, human rights, medical, religious, and needle exchange groups last September. The National Coalition to Save Lives Now organized a demonstration in front of Health and Human Services, where 11 people were arrested for trying to deliver a giant papier-mâché spine to Secretary Shalala. Congressional Republicans and the Office of National Drug Control Policy, headed by General Barry McCaffrey, oppose any federal funding of needle exchange programs. We're joined right now by Bob Fogel. He's a member of the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS. He's actually a litigation lawyer based in Chicago. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
Hi. Well, why don't you tell us about this very interesting split between the president's own advisory council on HIV/AIDS and the administration?
Well, Congress passed a law a number of years ago that required the Secretary of Health and Human Services to determine that needle exchange programs are effective in reducing HIV infections and do not increase drug use. And we believe, after quite a number of scientific studies and along with the American Medical Association, American Public Health Association, National Academy of Sciences, and many other mainstream organizations, that the science is in and that the programs do not increase drug use and are very effective. Right now, about 50% of new infections are related to injection drug users or their sex partners or even their children. The time has come to follow medical science and not political science.
Now, Mr. Fogel, you didn't come to the panel from a history in the AIDS prevention movement, did you? Could you tell us a little bit about your own background?
I'm a father of three teenagers, or kids who just became teenagers a couple of years ago, and had never been involved in HIV or AIDS issues. I was a strong supporter, early supporter of President Clinton, and after he was elected, I didn't want to move and couldn't move to Washington, so I looked at the lists of boards and commissions and saw the AIDS Advisory Council and said that was an issue I had never been involved in. It's something I and most of us should be interested in, particularly with teenagers, and requested to be put on this council. I thought I would bring a perspective as a lawyer, a parent, and a kind of a fresh view at the issue.
I mean, it's pretty incredible. I mean, the groups endorsing needle exchange programs range from the American Medical Association, National Institutes of Health, National Academy of Science, Congressional Black and Hispanic Caucus, even law enforcement. Some law enforcement officials have endorsed needle exchange programs. Explain where President Clinton and Donna Shalala are coming from.
Well, interestingly, you mentioned in your opening that Republicans in Congress oppose it, and that's actually not quite true. I went to a town hall meeting with Congressman John Porter, who's chairman of the Appropriations Committee, and he had gone to Baltimore and looked at their program. They have a very successful needle exchange program, and he announced at that meeting, at this town hall meeting here in Illinois, that he also now supported needle exchange programs. What we hear from Secretary Shalala's office, actually it was last February, 97, that she announced to Congress in a report that it was, in fact, needle exchange programs were, in fact, effective public health steps to reduce HIV infection. But she said she wanted to study the science further so that she could make the representation that it didn't increase drug use. I don't understand. Our council obviously doesn't understand what the delay is at this point, especially after the NIH, which is under HHS, Health and Human Services, had concluded in its own study that it was, in fact, it did not increase drug use. So at the moment, we understand that General McCaffrey's office, National Drug Control Policy, opposes needle exchange programs. And I think it's relatively easy to understand. They are concerned that a wrong message will be sent to people when the government helps fund exchanging of injection drug equipment.
And to what degree is the administration trying to respond to sentiment in Congress, and what kind of pressure is coming from Congress on this?
Well, you know, we understand when we get to Washington and when we talk to Sandy Thurman, the Director of Office of National AIDS Policy, and others in the administration that, you know, one of the concerns is that if the secretary takes the step of certifying needle exchange programs, that Congress might establish an even higher hurdle or a complete ban on federal funding and send us completely back to the dark ages. Something similar happened when the president wanted to change American immigration policy to allow HIV-infected people into the United States, and Congress kind of banned that and sent that idea failing. So I suppose they're, you know, Secretary Shalala probably is afraid to have been out front on this issue without a wink and a nod from the White House that they would back her up. That's one story we've heard. But some of her staff were at our meeting earlier this week in Washington and tell us that they may, in fact, be nearing the end of their internal analysis and may be ready to act.
So what is the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS, of which you're a member, Bob Fogel? What are your plans now? I mean, you've angrily criticized the administration's inaction on needle exchange programs, which you say can absolutely save lives. So what's going to happen?
Well, needle exchange is obviously a very, very important issue. The president made a commitment at a White House conference on AIDS that we had requested he hold, and he did in December of 95. And at that time, he made a commitment to reducing new infections each year until there are none. Now, that's a very serious statement and a very serious commitment. So over the last couple of years, we've been looking to see just what they've been doing. The epidemic, as I understood it originally, was obviously quite widespread. We have learned that it's turned into a bunch of mini-epidemics, and at the moment, with 50% of new infections related to injection drug use, if you want to get ahead of the epidemic, if in fact you want to, if you're serious about slowing it, if not stopping it, you've got to go to that particular hotspot. We also know that in communities of color, Latino and African-American communities, it is another very significant hotspot, and the government has been very slow in directing prevention efforts to those communities. So we kind of looked at the situation and said, can we have confidence in the president's commitment to ending the epidemic or reducing new infections? And unless they were to certify needle exchange programs as qualifying for federal funding, we had to say that the commitment was in question. So what we did at this last meeting was we had a vote of no confidence in the president's commitment. Hopefully that message has been received. In fact, I know it has been received by the president and his high-level staff people, and hopefully they can get General McCaffrey to understand to follow medical science and not political science.
And is your sense that as more reports have come out about the increasing effectiveness of some treatment and the reduction in the numbers of new cases, that there's a less of a sense of urgency in the country about being able to deal with the epidemic of AIDS?
Well, there really is not much of a decrease in new cases. What we hear all the time is regarding the new medicines, the protease inhibitors, that are currently prolonging the lives of people living with HIV and AIDS. There are indications that those new drugs are only going to be temporary in terms of keeping people alive. So while we have the benefit of the new medicines of keeping people living longer, we have to stop infecting new people. We have to reduce the number of new people. We're afraid, and science is beginning to suggest, that immunities will develop to these protease inhibitors or that the virus will mutate. So, you know, we are not winning the fight against HIV. We are certainly keeping people alive longer.
And the number that is estimated of people's lives that would be saved if needle exchange programs were allowed and funded in this country?
There's 40,000 new infections every year. At least 50% are directly related to injection drug users. So that's 20,000 a year, 33 every day. While we're having this conversation, at least one new person is becoming infected as a result of using a contaminated needle. You know, if you had talked to me about giving an injection drug user a clean needle before I got involved in this council and began to look at the issue, I would have said, no way. You know, that's wrong to do that. But the reality is, if you look at the science, it's no more likely to increase drug use than giving a smoker an extra pack of matches. They're not going to smoke more just because they have another match.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for...
Amy, before you let me go, I just want to say to Juan, my brother was at Columbia in 1968 playing basketball on that team. I don't know if you remember, they were sixth in the nation.
Oh, sure. Well, they had Davey Newmark, they had Jim MacMillan in those days.
Hayward Dotson.
Yeah, Hayward, yes, absolutely. I was a sports writer for The Spectator, so I know well.
And Bruce Fogel.
Yes, Bruce Fogel, sure.
Well, not to make Juan feel bad, but did Bruce graduate?
Yes, he did, and he's a very successful lawyer in Massachusetts. But, Juan, you're a successful writer, and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for having me today, and hopefully more people will write the Secretary and the President and urge them to act.
Thank you. Bob Fogel, member of the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS. He is a litigation lawyer based in Chicago. Juan, maybe when you actually get your Columbia College graduation certificate, you too could become a successful lawyer in Massachusetts.
Yes, that's a possibility. Yes.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, a quick update on why it is that the death row prisoners in Pennsylvania have ended their hunger strike. And then we're going to go to our second debate on the organic food standards being proposed by the USDA. And finally, a look at Cincinnati and what is this campaign finance lawsuit that has opened yesterday in court. Stay with us.
Rain shower, rain shower, done stirred up the blood and the Mississippi mud. Rain shower, dead flower, dead flower, and washed up in the mud, upside a tree, right here next to me. Road so slippery, I just can't get home, baby.
This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Dozens of death row prisoners at the Green State Penitentiary in Pennsylvania have called off their hunger strike after authorities agreed to lift draconian new prison rules. The regulations severely restrict prisoners' access to legal materials as well as the commissary. We've been following the story since it began last week. We're now joined once again by Steve Weiser, the spiritual advisor of Mumia Abu-Jamal. He's also a member of the Christian Bruderhof community. Mumia Abu-Jamal had joined that hunger strike earlier this week. Steve Weiser, you were in the prison yesterday in Pennsylvania where the prisoners were on hunger strike. What happened?
Yes, good morning, Amy. Well, the hunger strike is over. We don't know what happened behind the scenes, but the inmates down on death row have confirmed that with a number of our brothers and are very, very happy. We talked with the prison superintendent, Mr. Varner himself, and he himself confirmed it, that it was over and that they were working on all of the conditions which the inmates had demanded, which had been taken away from them.
For listeners who didn't hear yesterday's show or last week's show, can you explain very briefly what the prison, what those new rules the prison was instituting were?
Well, briefly, it was elimination of the commissary. That's all food and general supplies and so on. It was the reduction of their storage capacity to one small little box of all legal materials and all personal properties. And it was a drastic limitation of prison visiting rights and a few other items.
And is it your sense that the participation of Mumia Abu-Jamal, perhaps the most famous prisoner in American jails today, had some impact on the decision of the authorities to resolve the matter?
Well, it certainly seems so. I mean, he began on Monday, and yesterday it turned around 180 degrees dramatically.
Mm-hmm. We are talking to Steve Weiser, the spiritual advisor of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And again, the hunger strikers on death row in Pennsylvania seem to have won quite a victory. How often does this kind of protest take place, Steve?
This is the first time I've experienced it since I've been working with death row for 3 years now. They've had a hunger strike. A directive will be sent down from Camp Hill in the next couple days, and we will continue to monitor it very carefully to see if it really changes.
Well, we want to thank you very much for joining us. If people want to get more information on what's happening in the prison with Mumia Abu-Jamal and other death row prisoners, Steve Weiser, where can they call?
They could call me at 724-329-8573.
We want to thank you very much for joining us. Steve Weiser, spiritual advisor for Mumia Abu-Jamal. In just a few minutes, we're going to talk about the lawsuit in Cincinnati. Oral arguments were heard yesterday in a case that challenges campaign finance spending. We'll be speaking with John Boniface of the Voting Rights Institute, which is based in Massachusetts, and he's the lead attorney on the case. But right now, we're going to go to a second part of our discussion on the organic food standards. This is a discussion we started last week. This past December, Secretary of Agriculture Dan Glickman announced a proposed new national set of standards for the burgeoning organic food industry. Simply put, the new rules aim to set a uniform national standard about what is and what is not organic. Health activists say the wording of the proposal is too liberal and could result in hazardous toxins being classified as organic. Well, last week on Democracy Now!, we took a look at the proposed new rules and the storm of controversy that they've created. We got a ton of calls after the show. We'd like to play some of those comments. And then we'll be joined by two people to talk about one aspect of the proposal, and that is the issue of biotechnology. Which biotech food products would be allowed under organic food standards? Some might be surprised, any would be. But let's hear from some listeners first.
Hello, I would just like to say that agribusiness is too worried about competition from local organic farmers. Instead of fairly competing, agribusiness is now attempting to unfairly alter the standards of organic in order to erase the competition. The people want naturally grown organic food, not synthetically produced food that is falsely dubbed as organic. Thank you.
The USDA representative this morning said that they got 17,000 responses from the public. Well, they would have gotten three or four times more if they had allowed their wires to be open. Working Assets Long Distance did include this information and gave Dan Glicksman's number. But when you called, you either got a busy signal, I tried like six times, or then a machine plugged in which said that you couldn't leave a message on the phone, that you had to put everything in writing, and they gave a fax number and a mailing address. But he better know that he is dealing with health nuts, and we will get to it. Okay, thanks for your attention. Bye.
This is Dr. Mort Malkin calling about Amy Goodman's program today about organic certification. I want to give you the phone number of an organization that is very up-to-date on radiation of foods and the harm that that causes. They put out a journal called Food and Water, and their phone number is 1-800-EAT-SAFE. My own take on it is that I would like to see the USDA have lower fees charged for small family organic farms. Right now it's a flat fee basis, which is going to drive all the small farms out of business and allow only the large farms to turn to organic and produce supposedly organic foods. But they would want to do genetically engineered foods, which I oppose. They would use some sewage sludge as fertilizer, which I oppose. They would allow irradiated foods, which are harmful and may even cause cancer, some of the chemicals that are produced by the irradiation. And they should be, and they would probably refeed animal parts for livestock and use antibiotics and hormones for the livestock. Right now, 90% of all the meat produced in the U.S. is treated with hormones.
Hi, it's Richard Reynolds at Mother Jones. It just occurred to me, we just posted a story on the Mojo Wire on the organic, the USDA's decision on organic, what's organic. We got a leaked memo that came out sometime before they released their proposed standards last December that details some of the political pressures that led them to decide that, gee, maybe genetically altered foods can be called organic. And it was actually a concern over how our foreign trading partners would respond to our not labeling it organic. And, of course, as you probably heard, there's a barge of U.S. corn, genetically altered corn, that was just refused entry into Switzerland and is floating back down the Rhine under the watchful eyes of the Germans, who don't want it either. So, anyway, take a look at the story. It's on the MojoWare, www.motherjones.com.
And we want to thank you very much to all the listeners who've called in from around the country. We're going to be playing more comments, especially from grassroots activists around the country who are organizing around the organic food standards proposed by the USDA. You can give us a call at 212-564-7702 to let us know what you're doing and where you're calling from, and perhaps if you're a part of a group. That's 212-564-7702. But we're going to take up that last point of biotechnology today on this discussion and debate around organic food standards. It might surprise some that genetically engineered foods would actually be included in the organic food category, but they are under the USDA proposals. We're joined now by Joe Mendelson, an attorney with Organic Watch, a coalition of environmental groups and organic farmers critical of the proposed USDA regulations, and Alan Goldhammer, who is the executive director for technical affairs of the Biotechnology Industry Organization, known as BIO, the leading voice for the biotechnology industry in Washington, D.C. Interestingly enough, both of these men are against the proposed rules, although for very different reasons. Joe Mendelson, lay out for us, in the proposed U.S. Department of Agriculture rules, what is allowed when it comes to bioengineered foods?
Well, good morning, Amy and Juan. There are several things to go through in the rules that are important. First off, the USDA prefaces its proposed rule by saying it's going to take comments on whether consumers and people in the organic community and people in the rest of the country believe that genetically engineered foods and or materials should be allowed in the production of organic agriculture, and that is that these organisms or foods would be labeled organic. With that proposal open right now, the USDA is receiving a flood of comments, as you heard by your phone lines being jammed last week. The comment tally, I believe, is up close to about 30,000 right now. I would say in our organization, in looking at all those comments, we have not come across one single comment in favor of allowing biotechnology into the organic standards. Now, while I said that the USDA is taking questions on this issue, it actually has allowed two genetically engineered products to be used in its proposal. One is chymosinate, and the other is called killed BT, or a genetically engineered version of Bacillus thuringiensis, which is a naturally occurring organism that is used for pest control. Now, so we sort of have doublespeak. We have the USDA saying, should we allow this stuff in? And then here, they've allowed two specific genetically engineered product aids into the standard. Now, I should also point out that the National Organic Standards Board, which was created under the 1990 Organic Food Production Act, which has directed USDA in this effort, the National Organic Standards Board, which is consisted of environmentalists, organic farmers, producers, scientists, marketers, it's a citizens panel, was empowered with, through the law, to make recommendations to the secretary about what should be in the organic standards. They have specifically said that chymosin and killed BT should not be allowed in the standards on what's called the national list, and they have recommended a blanket prohibition on genetic engineering in organic standards. And despite the overwhelming recommendations of the National Organic Standards Board against genetic engineering in organic foods, and now the overwhelming public sentiment against it, we're still in a wait-and-see position right now.
Alan Goldhammer, as we said earlier with Biotechnology Industry Organization, you too are unhappy with the standards, but one might assume you would have been happy with them since some bioengineered foods are allowed under the proposal.
Well, I think you're right, Amy. Some are permitted, although they're not necessarily should be called foods. I think, as was noted, chymosin, which is used in cheese making, and the BT product, which is a microbial pesticide and used in insect control, are not foods per se. Our frustration stems from the work of the National Organic Standards Board. We submitted comments at length to them during the deliberative process, questioning why there should be a blanket exclusion for products of biotechnology, whether the products are food processing enzymes like chymosin or genetically engineered plants with enhanced disease or insect resistance. Our frustration stems from the fact that we never received any kind of comment back from the board as to what the criteria was for this exclusion. Yet there was the underlying assumption that they would accept the use of hybrid seeds and other products which require a great deal of human intervention to create, and yet biotechnology products were excluded. So our sense is that we do believe that biotechnology should be eligible for the use in organic farming, provided that the underlying concepts of organic practices are adhered to, that is, you know, no synthetical chemical inputs and so forth.
Well, let me ask you, for example, I've got a list here of some of these agricultural products on the market as a result of biotechnology. One of them is Fresh World Farms Endless Summer Tomato, and it says the Endless Summer Tomato is a genetically engineered version of the Fresh World Farms tomato on the market since April 1993 and shares its superior color, taste, and texture. What's new is its greatly extended shelf life of more than 30 to 40 days after harvest. Company scientists used TransWitch technology to suppress production of ethylene, the hormone that causes tomatoes and other fruits to ripen. It is the company's first whole food product developed through recombinant DNA technology. Now, is it your sense that this type of product should be included as organic food, and why?
Well, we do believe that it should be categorized as organic, and again, because there are already existing products that do something similar, that are created through natural breeding. If one would look at the seed catalogs that come to all of us backyard gardeners in the in December and January, there are tomato varieties that have delayed ripening properties, and those seeds are marketed as you know, harvest them in August and eat them in December. Yet these are not created through biotechnology, and yet the Fresh World product, which is, for some reason, gets stigmatized. And all that we would like is a simple explanation as to what is the criteria for drawing this line in the sand. If there's an acceptance of hybrid seeds and not an acceptance of biotechnology-derived products, we'd like to know the reason why.
Joe Mendelson, maybe you'd like to offer a reason why the tomato that Juan just talked about should not be included as organic just because it's able to last for something like 40 days.
Sure. First, Juan, I'd like to say, could you send me that advertising or production piece that you've seen, because the company seems to be making claims that it's materially altered the tomato, and if it has done so, then under the Federal Food and Drug and Cosmetic Act, that genetically engineered tomato should be labeled for consumers, and that's something is a different issue outside of organic. But
I should say, Joe, that
we
got that actually from Alan Goldhammer's organization, Biotechnology Industry Organization, their own website, www.bio.org.
Well, great. Alan, thanks for that.
There's a whole
it.
List of products that are currently available that you can look up.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, not being a member of the NOSB, I can't specifically speak as to what their criteria was. I know they have gone through a long, lengthy 6-year deliberative process, taking comments from a whole host of people, public hearings. You know, I think it's unrealistic to suggest that they could get back to everyone on exactly what comments they've taken. I think when the people charged at the NOSB look at organic as a production standard that is based in ecological and sustainable practices, I think there's generally a feeling that to allow biotechnology in any form opens up a Pandora's box, a slippery slope. Once you have a chymosin or a killed BT, it sets a standard that genetically engineered products are allowed in organic agriculture, and that takes us down the road to where we get things like the tomato, we get transgenic corn, as was mentioned on the barge, which is a uses genetically engineered technology to put Bacillus thuringiensis into the corn. There are a number of ecological problems with that, including gene flow to other organisms, the impacts on the BT on non-target beneficial organisms. So I think the organic community feels that, in general, that biotechnology is not consistent with organic principles, and I think that's probably the reasoning the NOSB has taken its position.
We're talking to Joe Mendelson, attorney with Organic Watch, a coalition of environmental groups and organic farmers critical of the proposed USDA organic food regulations. We're also joined on the phone by Alan Goldhammer, executive director of biotechnology industry organization called BIO, a leading voice for biotechnology industry in Washington, D.C. We're going to continue this discussion after stations identify themselves, and then we're going to find out about a lawsuit going on in Cincinnati around campaign finance reform. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we bring you part two of our discussion on the proposed organic food standards that the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, has put out and is now having public hearings around the country. Our guests now are Joe Mendelson of Organic Watch, a coalition of environmental groups and organic farmers critical of the proposed USDA standards, and Alan Goldhammer, he's Executive Director for Technical Affairs of Biotechnology Industry Organization, which is a voice for the biotechnology industry. They're actually both critical of some of the standards being proposed by the USDA. Alan Goldhammer, because it doesn't allow in enough biotechnologically engineered foods, and Joe Mendelson, I suppose, because it allows any in. I wanted to follow up on one of our listeners who called in that we just played earlier. It was actually a spokesperson for Mother Jones Magazine who said that on the Mojo Wire, that's on the internet of the Mother Jones Magazine, they have a piece out that talks about how bioengineered foods from the United States that have been sent to European countries have been turned back because they are not considered organic. And if they're labeled organic, they will not accept them. Joe Mendelson, can you talk a little about this and what the USDA standards would mean for U.S. trade abroad?
Absolutely. I think a number of organic farmers and producers and processors are very concerned that the standard as written by the USDA would inhibit their export. Frankly, the EU, also some of the international standards being developed at the organization called Codex Alimentarius, the International Forum of Organic Agricultural Movements, IFOAM standards, which are used in a great deal in an international setting, all do not allow genetically engineered foods. And so we've got a situation where the U.S. is really setting the bottom here. If it's not allowed in the EU, or if the EU does not allow genetic engineering, it's certainly not going to allow products to be imported into those countries that may contain genetically engineered organisms when it's labeled organic. And I think it represents a serious threat to the organic agricultural sector. We're now dealing with an industry that's $3 billion a year, growing at a clip of 20%, in the fastest growing agricultural sector in the United States. And I think we should do everything in our means to allow what is an ecological production standard to be developed fully in this country. And that would mean supporting exports, and that would mean not allowing genetically engineered in the standard.
Alan Goldhammer, what about what's going on in Europe? And also, if you could comment a little bit about what is happening to genetically engineered food products in the third world? What kind of a market is opening up there?
Yeah, to take your points one at a time, right now the only products that are being exported to Europe are the major grains, primarily corn and soybeans. There are both genetically engineered corn and genetically engineered soybeans that are being exported. These, however, are not being labeled as organic because they're grown, by and large, by farmers using chemical inputs. Nobody is assuming that there is going to be a significant market for organic corn and soybeans. Clearly, we don't believe there should be export barriers with regard to food labeling. I don't know, simply because USDA does not keep statistics on the export of organic crops to Europe, as to what the market size might be. Clearly, there are really significant transportation costs that would be associated, say, with the shipment of tomatoes or, say, other fruits and vegetables to Europe. I'm not sure what the level of export is there in, as to whether it is significant or not. Your second point, the third world, there are a number of approaches that are being developed by both third world scientists and some of the academic scientists in this country to expand the use of biotechnology crops in the third world. A good example would be cassava, which is used as a major food in sub-Saharan Africa. There are a number of pests to this crop which are amenable to control through biotechnology. There's some significant genetic engineering approaches that are being explored to control both insects and viruses on it, and I think that it will be, in the long run, quite useful in the creation of new varieties that will allow that sector of the world to become greater in terms of self-sufficient food production.
But the question here isn't whether or not you can use biotechnologically engineered foods and sell them, but whether they're labeled properly. And it seems that something that the that biogenetically engineered foods lobby like yours has fought against, and it's the issue of properly identifying what is a bioengineered product.
Well, that's correct. And I think what you need to look at is a concept of what many of the international groups have come up with, and that's called substantial equivalence. Any crop that one grows has a great deal of variability. We did a report about 9 years ago now that looked at just the inherent variability in crops, not biotechnology-derived, but just standard crops that are grown. And one can see, you know, vitamin levels, nutrient levels. You know, there can be 5, 6, 7, 8-fold differences depending on the climatic conditions where the crop is grown, soil fertility, a variety of other conditions. So it's not to, I don't think that you can make the assumption that the tomato that you grow in your backyard up in the New York area is the same and has the same exact nutrients as the tomato that I grow in my backyard down here in Maryland. I think if you subject that to you know, some analytical test, you'll find out that the answer to that is probably no. So the concept is, well, what is generally equivalent? And when we look at that, I think that there then becomes really not much difference at all between a biotechnology-derived crop and one that is grown through traditional breeding practice.
Joe Mendelson, we're going to give you the last word. We just have a minute from Organic Watch.
Thanks. I, you know, being an attorney, I can argue just about anything being equivalent, and I think what is happening with genetically engineered foods, and this is in the greater context, is that we have not resolved some of the safety issues regarding around genetic stability of the products when we're adding and inserting, deleting whatever genetic material in the organic sense. The community and the public is almost united in saying it does not want it in the standard. So, you know, we will take all means at Organic Watch to make sure that the organic standard does not include any type of genetically engineered food or products. And people who want to get in touch with us, please contact us at 202-547-9359, or you can email us at owatch@icta.org and just put OWATCH in the subject box so we can make sure it's going to the right place.
So that number,
and Juan,
two...
congratulations, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
That number, 202-547-9359. That's 202-547-9359. And the email address, owatch.icta.
owatch@icta.org.
And Alan Goldhammer, the website of Biotechnology Industry Organization? That is, actually, I've got it, www.bio.org. That's www.bio.org. I want to thank you both very much for joining us as we move on to our next segment. And for listeners who are just joining us, why Joe is just congratulating Juan is he is about to, that we don't want to be presumptuous here because he hasn't actually gotten it, about to graduate from college 30 years later. So we're going to keep reminding you of this, Juan, and our listeners.
And I'd like to say that this this food discussion that we're continuing, and we will continue, is so critical because all the attention being placed on the sexual shenanigans in the White House, this is about the future of the food supply of the country and how the labeling process and the consumers will be aware of what they are eating. We think that's a lot more critical.
Well, right now, we're going to move to another issue. We're going to go to Cincinnati, where a federal appeals court is hearing arguments from activist attorneys opposed to the flood of campaign money pouring into local, state, and federal elections. The court will decide whether limits on the amount of money that candidates can spend would violate free speech. The case is an effort to reopen a landmark 1976 U.S. Supreme Court ruling that equated unlimited campaign spending with free speech, a decision that's foiled numerous efforts to reduce the influence of money in politics ever since. John Bonifast joins us now. He's an attorney and director of the National Voting Rights Institute, which is a public interest litigation and education group based in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome, John, and tell us about the case today.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you for having me. The case is a very important case in terms of dealing with the influence of money in our politics today. The city of Cincinnati enacted reasonable campaign spending limits in 1995 as a means of addressing what it found to be a major threat to its democratic process, coming with unlimited campaign spending. And it did so with full awareness of the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in Buckley v. Valeo, but with the view that the facts and circumstances in the past 22 years had changed to warrant a reconsideration of that ruling. 24 states with their state attorneys general and 21 secretaries of state have joined in this effort, have filed a friend of the court brief in support of the Cincinnati ordinance. The U.S. Justice Department has signaled that it is looking closely at this case for the potential United States intervention, and I think that ultimately Buckley v. Valeo will have to be revisited on this crucial point.
And what precisely does the Cincinnati ordinance say?
The City of Cincinnati ordinance says that candidates running for city council elections may not spend more than three times the salary for city council, which is approximately $46,000 a year. So the limits are overall $140,000. For a city of approximately 300,000 people, it's an extremely reasonable limit. Some might say that it's, in fact, quite high. But the reality is that what Cincinnati has witnessed over the past several election cycles is a skyrocketing rise in the cost of elections, with the last candidate in 1997 spending an all-time high of nearly $500,000 to get elected to the city council of Cincinnati.
Wow. Now, according to your organization, the National Voting Rights Institute, only two cities have set campaign spending limits: Cincinnati, the case you're arguing now, and also Albuquerque, New Mexico, that set spending limits two decades ago.
Right. Albuquerque is almost a place that time forgot on this question. In 1974, they enacted mandatory campaign spending limits along with contribution limits. Then the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 1976 that congressional campaign spending limits were unconstitutional on free speech grounds. Most states that had spending limits on the books, I would say all states actually, removed those spending limits after that decision. Albuquerque did not. No one ever challenged Albuquerque's limits until last year. Mayoral candidates and city council candidates ran under these limits for 23 years. And the real question is, was the First Amendment, in fact, infringed upon in Albuquerque during those 23 years, or was it enhanced? And we think we can show that there was an open and robust debate, there was more competition, there was more democracy in Albuquerque because of an effort to curtail the disproportionate influence of moneyed interests in Albuquerque politics. Now, Cincinnati enacted these limits in 95 after recognizing that unlimited campaign spending was threatening the democratic process. Their limits have not ever gone into effect because of this lawsuit, but I think that combined with Albuquerque, it demonstrates there is an early legal movement in the courts on this to revisit this critical question of our democracy.
And John Boniface, what about the whole issue, for instance, that most of the money that's spent or raised and spent on election campaigns goes into advertising on television? In essence, the biggest moneymakers of political campaigns are the television networks and local TV stations. What about this whole issue of these, since these are public airwaves, requiring a certain amount of time be set aside for all candidates by these television networks as another strategy to deal with this issue?
Well, first let me say that, you know, as an organization, the National Voting Rights Institute endorses a number of different efforts that are going on, and one of them certainly is an effort calling for free media time, and I think that that makes total sense. But the reality is that Cincinnati nor Albuquerque has any jurisdiction over that. That is effectively controlled by the Federal Communications Commission and by Congress. So Cincinnati, within its own authority, can enact reasonable campaign spending limits to try to address this, but ultimately for dealing with free media time, we need to go to the federal government.
And what's the timetable on this lawsuit in Cincinnati? You presented oral arguments this week. What happens now?
Well, we're awaiting a decision. It may very well take months from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit to issue its ruling, and then following that, we will either be going back to trial if we get what we want to get, which is a fair hearing on all the facts of this, which has to happen at trial, or if we get an unfavorable decision, we will then seriously consider appealing to the Supreme Court.
Well, I want to thank you, John Boniface, for joining us. It's very interesting what you're doing. You're really a leader in this movement that sees the whole issue of campaign finance spending as a new kind of voting rights act, that you're challenging this notion that it threatens free speech but actually allows more, and it's a movement that's growing around the country. John Boniface, if you could give us your phone number where people can call if they want to get more information around legislation around the country and what people are doing, the number of the National Voting Rights Institute.
Absolutely. It's 617-368-9100 in Boston. 617-368-9100. And it's an honor to be on Democracy Now!
Well, thank you very much for joining us, John Boniface with the National Voting Rights Institute. Well, that does it for today's show. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And Juan, I'm going to leave you with this question that I hope you'll answer tomorrow on Democracy Now! If you get your college degree, when you grow up, what do you want to be? So think about that and tell us tomorrow. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Jeremy Scahill is our director. Errol Maitland and engineered from New York. Joe Gill engineered from Washington. Julie Drizin's our executive producer. Michelle Garcia is our webmeister. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!